worked with Mac Bundy on drafting a final report for the State Department's disarmament panel. This document was forwarded to departing Secretary of State Acheson just as Dwight D. Eisenhower moved into the White House. At the time, of course, this paper was highly classified and circulated among only a handful of Eisenhower administration officials. Had it been released in 1953, it surely would have created a firestorm of controversy. While Bundy was the document's wordsmith, many of the ideas were Oppenheimer's. Nuclear weapons would soon threaten all civilization. In just a few years, the Soviet Union could have 1,000 atomic bombs, and 5,000 only a few years further on. This constituted the power to end a civilization and a very large number of people in it. Bundy and Oppenheimer conceded that a nuclear stalemate between the Soviets and the United States might evolve into a strange stability in which both sides would refrain from using these suicidal weapons. But if so, a world so dangerous may not be very calm, and to maintain the peace it will be necessary for statesmen to decide against rash actions not just once, but every time. They concluded that, unless the contest in atomic armaments is in some way moderated, our whole society will come increasingly into peril of the gravest kind. In the face of such peril, the Oppenheimer panelists promoted the idea of candor. A policy of excessive secrecy had kept Americans complacent and ignorant of the nuclear peril. To rectify matters, the new administration should tell the story of the atomic danger. Astonishingly, the panelists even recommended that the rate and impact of atomic production should be revealed to the public, and that it should direct attention to the fact that beyond a certain point, we cannot ward off the Soviet threat merely by keeping ahead of the Russians. The notion of candor was directly inspired by Niels Bohr, who had always insisted that security was inextricably linked to openness. In this, Oppie was still Bohr's prophet. He no longer put any stock in the long deadlocked UN disarmament talks, but he hoped that a new administration would see that candor could both alert the American people to the real perils of relying on nuclear weapons and signal to the Soviets that Americans did not intend to use these weapons in a preemptive first strike. In addition, the disarmament panel urged direct, continual communication with the Soviets. The Kremlin should know roughly the size and nature of the American nuclear arsenal, and that Washington strongly favored bilateral talks to reduce this arsenal. If the recommendations of the Oppenheimer panel had been accepted by the Eisenhower administration in 1953, the Cold War might have taken a different, less militarized trajectory. This tantalizing speculation was later advanced by Bundy in his 1982 essay in the New York Review of Books, The Missed Chance to Stop the H-Bomb. And in the years since the demise of the Soviet Empire, Russian archival documents have compelled historians to rethink basic assumptions about the early Cold War. The enemy archives, as the historian Melvin Leffler has written, demonstrate that the Soviets did not have preconceived plans to make Eastern Europe communist, to support the Chinese communists, or to wage war in Korea. Stalin had no master plan for Germany and wished to avoid military conflict with the United States. At the end of World War II, Stalin reduced his army from 11,356,000 in May 1945 to 2,874,000 in June 1947, suggesting that even under Stalin, the Soviet Union had neither the capability nor the intention to launch a war of aggression. George F. Kennan later wrote that he never believed that they, the Soviets, have seen it in their interest to overrun Western Europe militarily, or that they would have launched an attack on that region generally even if the so-called nuclear deterrent had not existed. Stalin ran a cruel police state, but economically and politically it was a totalitarian state in decay. When Stalin died in March 1953, his successors, Georgi Malenkov and Nikita Khrushchev, began a process of de-Stalinization. Both Malenkov and Khrushchev also had a sound appreciation for the inherent dangers of a nuclear arms race. Malenkov, a technocrat with an interest in quantum physics, stunned the Politburo in 1954 with a speech in which he said that the use of the hydrogen bomb in war would mean the destruction of world civilization. Khrushchev, an erratic, mercurial leader, sometimes frightened Western audiences with his blustery rhetoric. But in practice, he pursued the kind of foreign policy that would later become associated with détente, and even exhibited the first glimmers of glasnost. He renewed arms control talks with the West in 1955, and by the end of the 1950s, he had sharply cut the Soviet defense budget. After receiving his first briefing on nuclear weapons in September 1953, Khrushchev later recalled, "I couldn't sleep for several days. Then I became convinced that we could never possibly use these weapons." It would have required extraordinary efforts to persuade Khrushchev to embrace the kind of radical arms control regime Oppenheimer's panel envisioned. But the Eisenhower administration never even tried to go down that path. Yet no less a Sovietologist than the highly regarded U.S. ambassador to Moscow, Charles Chip Bohlen, later wrote in his memoirs that Washington's failure to engage Malenkov in meaningful negotiations over nuclear weapons and other issues was a missed opportunity. By 1953, the Cold War had frozen the policy options in Washington at least as hard as they were frozen in Moscow, and Oppenheimer's persistent efforts to somehow keep the nuclear genie attached to the bottle, if not in it, ran against the current of powerful forces at home. Now that a Republican was president, these political forces were determined to put Oppenheimer into a bottle and throw him out to sea.